This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
All right, we're back in action today. Hours away from our first debate. It's going to be exciting. A lot of stuff going on today. Besides the major headlines, you have Speaker Johnson doing something we've been discussing on this show. They're going to have a big debate on men playing in women's sports. Virginia Fox is going to be co-hosting it. One of the guests is going to be NCAA swimmer Riley Gaines. As more and more men who want to be women try to win gold medals, I'm not sure how that's going to happen, but I'm sure in one way or shape or form, women will be hurt by it. And this is something else we've been discussing, and I should be doing this more. A House Judiciary Subcommittee hearing radio music and copyrights, 100 years of inequity for recording artists. And look, everyone thinks these recording artists are all getting rich. You would be shocked how little they get from the music they write and sing. Shocked. Stunned. That's why they got to do so many concerts. That's why it's so hard to break out. It is totally wrong. They are the engine behind it. I hope something comes out of that. I know it's not a headline, but all that music that you're listening to, the artists you look up to, I just think that these are the people that are producing the product that you like, and you'd be shocked to see everybody else getting rich except them. Today, to President Trump's immense credit, he's holding a Black American Business Leadership Barbershop Roundtable. On Friday, he's going to be with Glenn Youngkin in Virginia. You know what he was doing over the weekend in Philadelphia. He had a fundraiser the other day. And where's the President of the United States? Hold up. Let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
Unfortunately, we see a great deal of violence committed by illegal immigrants, and we see as many victimized by other illegals and regular people here. So it's an enormous problem. This was bound to happen.
Death and destruction at the border, and more criminals pour in, and more innocents die. Both parties blame each other. I blame Joe Biden.
Number two.
You know Jamal Bowman ain't going nowhere, right? Because there's a lot of other seats to run for, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I know what you're saying. Stop screaming into the microphone, you loser. Primary day results. So the squad loses a radical soldier, you just heard him, in Jamal Bowman. He's humiliated by a moderate, gets crushed in double figures after just one term because he's an embarrassment to everyone that knows him. Could Cori Bush be the next to pay the price? Also, stakes heat up on the VP shortlist. Guess what? It got just a slightly bit larger. I'll give you the information I got last night.
Number one.
And points to some of the strategy likely behind trying to have this debate so early in the election year. No matter what happens on Thursday, both sides will have some time to try to, you know, change those polls and get back in the lead before November.
Debate day one, one day away. Insight into the Trump game plan while President Biden spends days drilling behind closed doors. Why is that? Why would a sitting president need this much prep? I think I know. Brett Baer does, too. He joins us now. Brett's chief political analyst, Fox News, anchor special report. And he wishes he could be doing this, moderating this debate. He's not. Brett, don't you find it odd that President Biden needs this much time for hours to work on pre-debate prep?
Yes. I mean, I don't think we've ever seen this in modern history where a president is holed up for a week prepping. So now, it is true that presidents running for reelection usually don't perform well in that first debate. We've seen it numerous times because they have a job, a day job, where they're really focused on the day job. And sometimes they put that on the back burner. We saw with President Obama in his first reelection debate against Mitt Romney. He did poorly, and he would concede that, and so would their people. That said, 7 days hold up at Camp David is something we've never seen.
So I went and watched the 2020 debate. And I was struck by a few things. Number one, in terms of crassness, yeah, Trump interrupted. Biden interrupted, too. I just wrote this down. These are some of the words that came out of the vice president's mouth who became president. Trump is a fool when it comes to masks. Shut up, man. Shush up. Why wouldn't he shush up? Quote, you were the worst president we've ever had. Shut up. Says he brought back Chrysler and Chrysler himself. He brought Chrysler and GM back himself. That's interesting. I'm sure Barack Obama loved that. He said, hard to get any word in with this clown. And then he went and said, Trump, you're a racist. So people talk about Trump being crass and, you know, that, you know, going not going with decorum. I mean, it was Biden throwing out a lot of these blasts at him, just kind of barroom stuff. I think they were both doing it. And it's amazing how much, if you watch back, and I think I encourage everyone to do it. It's on YouTube. It's free. How much of what Trump said about the pandemic, which no one wants to talk about anymore, I don't either, ended up coming true. About masks, about the vaccine. The mass vaccine's not going to be ready to the summer. He goes, no, I think it could be ready sooner. He goes, your medical expert said it's not going to be ready soon. He goes, hey, my medical experts, I just spoke to him. I think we're going to get something by the winter. He was 100% right. Anthony Fauci was everywhere in masks. No, he wasn't. Yes, he was. He originally told us not to wear masks. So much of this stuff ended up coming out right. And then him saying you're responsible for killing 200,000 people, which is a heck of a thing to say to the president. But he ends up killing more with the vaccine than Trump died under Trump without a vaccine. There's a lot of stuff. I don't know what you go back to. I think you have to go back to the 51 Intel experts who said that laptop was disinformation, because now we know exactly how that happened. Brett, do you see that coming up tomorrow night?
I mean, it would if I was moderating. But I think that, you know, because that is something that directly happened in that debate that we have clearly seen has not transpired. And the vice president then, now the president, has never been confronted with that. It's the last time these two men were on the stage together, and arguably that issue, that moment, you know, it set off all of this social media banning of the Hunter story. It did affect things, and I would think that that would be ripe to come up. I highly doubt it will come up. That's, I'm just being honest. I don't know if that's going to, you know, raised to the level of what these two moderators think is important. And but I wish it would, because it's obviously a big thing.
I was going to play for our audience, because Congressman Jordan went through it brilliantly. And this is how you do it, Brett. No one knows better than you. You moderated a million of these. So very easy. You answer this question about immigration. But I just kind of wonder, why do we trust Joe Biden for anything? Because you lied to us 4 years ago, you never apologized for, when you looked right into that camera and said 51 Intel experts said that laptop was Russian disinformation, when you knew it was your son's. You knew those were your personal emails. You knew those were your son's horrendous pictures. What is it like to stare into that camera, Joe, and just lie? When are we going to know when you're lying and telling the truth? It's so easy to get onto that other topic. But listen to it. This is what I just think is so insidious. Cut 16.
Blinken calls Morrell. Everyone knew Morrell wanted to be the CIA director in the Biden administration. Morrell organizes the statement that 51 people signed. When he sends out the statement, he says, this is so Joe Biden will have a talking point against Trump during the upcoming debate. After the debate, Joe Biden's campaign chairman, Steve Ricchetti, calls Morrell and thanks him. Now we've learned three new additional facts. The letter was actually reviewed by the top people at the CIA, either Director Haspel or Deputy Director Bishop. We deposed the chief operating officer, Andrew McCratus. He said, I took it to one of those two individuals. They reviewed it. Agents looked at this and said, this is not what the CIA should be doing. This is a bad look for the CIA. This is all political. Some of the people who signed it, like Mike Morrell, were actually on contract with the CIA when they signed it. That's how political this was. This is something our government had for a year. They had the laptop, and they knew it wasn't hacked by Russia.
What about the fact that Gina Haspel, the sitting CIA director appointed by President Trump, saw it and signed off on it, perhaps, or her deputy?
Yeah.
This is huge.
It is a big deal. And, you know, it goes to this kind of bureaucracy protecting its own, you know, that the president and his allies talk about all the time. I, you know, for the longest time, the perception is that some of these talking points about the deep state and all of that are just over the top and too much. But every time we go down these roads, there is another shoe that drops in this kind of this narrative. And again, I think it's a big story. And again, I doubt it's going to be asked about.
All right. I'll tell you what. Let's bet, Brett. I'll bet you'll have to come on my show on Saturday night, and I'll have to come on yours if I lose the bet.
Okay.
All right. On the panel. And okay. I'll let everyone. My Kyron will be Brian lost the bet when I'm on your show.
Okay.
So listen to. You're in an odd situation like this. I can't remember specifically, but sometimes people come on your show. You have a lot of Democrats on your show, and they'll insult people on our channel, and it puts you in an odd spot. But to me, this is not how you handle it. Let's listen to Carolyn Leavitt on with Casey Hunt.
What do you expect from Joe Biden?
Well, first of all, it would take someone 5 minutes to Google Jake Tapper, Donald Trump, to see that Jake Tapper has consistently frequently likened President Trump to Adolf Hitler.
Ma'am, I'm going to stop this interview if you continue to attack my colleagues. I would like to talk about Joe Biden and Donald Trump, who you work for.
Yes.
If you are here to speak on his behalf, I am willing to have this conversation.
I am stating facts that your colleagues have stated in the past.
Okay.
Now,
I'm sorry,
this debate,
guys. We're going to come back out to the panel. Caroline, thank you very much for your time. You are welcome to come back at any point. She is welcome to come back and speak about Donald Trump, and Donald Trump will have equal time.
So they're the moderators. That's what's different. You're not just going off on anybody because you don't like their show. They're the moderators, and that is a concern for the Trump team. But what do you think about the way she handled it?
Listen, you know, hindsight's 20/20, but I think a lot of people would have handled that differently. I actually think that the spokesperson was making the turn. She was saying now, you know, this is I'm going to answer your question. So I think she had already gotten around that corner, and she would have gotten an answer to the question that she asked. But instead, she did the whole cutoff and said she's welcome to come back, but she never came back. They cut her off and said goodbye. So I just don't think that that's the best way to handle that moment, especially, you know, 3 days ahead of a debate you're moderating where you're at least appearing to be fair to both sides.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, that's what people are concerned about, because Jake Tapper and Dana Bash, they cut him off. They mock Trump like he's Alex Jones. They look at what he said. Oh, he's lying again. We have a fact checker full time to punt it. He's lying. And Dana Bash indicated when he was allowed to be on all these ballots because it was unconstitutional to kick off a candidate from a ballot. He said, sadly, basically, he's going to stay on the ballot for president of the United States. And those people are already on the record with a bias against him. So Trump accepted the terms anyway. Why do you think he accepted the terms anyway?
Listen, I think, you know, there was a possibility for the campaign for the former president to leverage some things about make the debate the way he wanted it, not in all elements, but to at least negotiate. But I think his thought process was that they're going to try to set up these bad scenarios and so that I won't accept it. And then they will say, oh, he won't accept it. We're not doing the debate. So his thought process, I think, was I'm accepting everything. And, you know, I get the short end of the stick anyway in the media, so I can handle it. And I think he thinks that by doing that, he roped in Biden, which is why he's holed up in Camp David for 7 days practicing for Thursday night.
I talked to a Trump official last night, and he said that they accepted, and I think they made these terms so severe, thinking that Trump would walk away from it and they wouldn't get away without doing the debate, and that they were shocked that they accepted it. And if they pushed back on demands, it would have given them a reason to have it to fall apart. So this is what, just the mechanics of it. I'm just fascinated to get your take. There's going to be six sections. Two, according to the Trump team, are in their ballpark. The other four are in Biden's ballpark. They also said they're under the assumption that Biden knows the questions already. They just believe that he has been briefed on them. This is the format. Candidate A gets the question and gets 2 minutes. Candidate B gets 1 minute for rebuttal. Candidate A gets to rebut the rebuttal. Your thoughts about how that would work with the mics killed in between?
I mean, again, that you're going to miss maybe some of the "you're good enough," you know, comment like Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. You're going to miss some of that once the mic is cut. I think that that's fine. You know, the timing is fine. 2 minutes is fine to make your case. 1 minute for a rebuttal. It's all fine. I think that the topics, if it's true that it's 2 and 4 in the Trump mindset, that means that it's immigration and economy, and then it's January 6th, abortion, criminal cases, and something else. That's a problem. You know, I think that if you looked at the top items in a poll that voters care about, that's where your questions should be, you know, based on what that is. Now, threat to democracy is one of them, one of the buckets, but we'll see how it plays out. I really hope for the moderators that they have that thought process going in, that I'm going to try to be as fair as I can.
And then I asked him, too. I said, but is there going to be any exchange? Is there going to be any way they just open up the mics and let them engage on a topic? I mean, isn't that going to be necessary? And they said, yeah, there will be. I'm thinking to myself, how? If you're going to go with, you didn't say that. Unless I missed it, they didn't say it. So how are they going to just let them go, which they should at some point let them go? They don't want it out of control, but they should at one point let them go.
Well, I suppose that you control your time. So if in the 2 minutes or in the 1 minute you say, Joe, what did you mean by XYZ, and you turn to him and you use your time to confront. Now, he doesn't have to answer your question, but it would be awkward if he doesn't. So then the rebuttal is the back and forth, you know.
Okay, that's great. So you could use some of your time to engage. Interesting. That makes sense. And the other thing would be gesticulations. They'll be in a two-shot when the other one's answering. And the other thing is, you know how microphones work? You could still hear the echo of somebody's comment in the background if they're
sure,
in the vicinity.
Studio.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. All right, Brett.
That's the other thing. It's not going to be an audience. But, you know, in reality, the audience in a general election debate is not really a factor. It's only in these primary debates where we have packed, you know, places that it really reacts.
Brett Baer, thanks so much. We watch you tomorrow night and get your show. Of course, 6 o'clock special report. Brett Baer, thank you.
We'll see you.
You got it. Rich Lowry coming up the bottom of the hour. You're next. Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
A radio show like no other. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Yeah, I think it's going to be really interesting. It's going to be an interesting day. I give Trump tremendous thumbs up for having a Black American Business Leaders Barbershop Roundtable. Think about this. He has the South Bronx rally, went great. Went to Detroit, met with Black church leaders, went great. Then he goes to Philadelphia, huge crowd, unbelievable, evidently extremely well-received, absolutely no protesters. And today he goes to Atlanta, and where they say, well, you can't win the urban vote, you can't go to Atlanta and be successful. Well, maybe not, but I'm going to try. The Trump campaign holds a Black American Business Leaders Barbershop. How do I know this is effective? Because you know who came out and spoke about it? James Clyburn. He is panicked. You know, he's 80-something. Nice enough guy. Famously said, my parents were Republicans. Why? Because he grew up in the South. And guess who were the segregationists? Guess who were the Jim Crow people? It was Senator Byrd and others like him, the Ku Klux Klan. They were all Democrats. James Clyburn grew up a Democrat because in the 1960s, the Democrats passed the civil rights legislation. Excuse me, the president was Democrat that did it, but Republican votes delivered it. He said, I have urged elder blacks to talk to their kids. They should try and talk some sense into their children. I know what I had to go through. I knew what my parents went through. If I see and hear from my candidate, they want to bring these indignities back to the process. I have the obligation to sit these children down of mine and say, what the hell are you thinking about? Well, they're thinking about voting for Trump.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
The message to the Biden campaign, between the polling numbers and the amount of money that Donald Trump has been raising at the extraordinary clip after the post-conviction, should be a warning to Democrats, not just at the top of the card, but all the way to the bottom, that the American public is waiting for a reckoning of some kind. They just haven't decided in which direction they intend to go. What it tells you is that people are just generally dissatisfied.
That is Hank Shinecoff, more of a New York expert, but an election savant, talking about what the polling numbers are telling you. And what they're saying is, well, for young people, this is the difference. I can go over microanalyze, but here's what's different. The president, the former president's getting more of the black vote than any other Republican, probably prior to 1960. Okay, Eisenhower. But I don't even remember what the black vote was there. I don't know if I've seen it recorded, but it just became apparent that Democrats were going to get the black vote my whole life. I was born in 64. So now Trump's up in double figures. That's significant. And then he's up in near the 20s. That's significant. And then he's over 30 with men, black men. And they're panicking on the left. Also with under 30, evidently they're looking more and more at Donald Trump. And the Hispanic votes, virtual dead heat, which would be a win for Trump. Is it panic? Is that why James Clyburn's out there urging parents, black parents, to inform their black kids they're being foolhardy if they vote for Trump? Rich Lowry joins us now. Hey, Rich, how worried do you think the Biden campaign is about the black vote? Guess where Trump is today? At a barbershop in Atlanta.
Yeah, I think they're very worried. And, you know, this kind of polling numbers we haven't seen in a very, very long time. I think Democrats, if I'm not mistaken, have been winning the black vote since the New Deal. But the 60s was a real inflection point. And, you know, I'm more optimistic about the Latino vote in Trump than I am the black vote. But any incremental change, just 2 or 3 points, could be decisive in one of these blue wall states, you know, which have rural parts but also have big cities that matter a lot. And if you take the edge off the Biden margin, that could be enough to win a narrow race.
I mean, the area which the president, it's odd, the former president's losing traction is seniors. Why would that be?
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't understand it. It's really bizarre. So Trump's doing well in all the polling in Arizona and New Mexico because he's doing so well among Latinos. And it's not as though, you know, he's ahead in a lot of these polls in the blue wall states, but it's closer, and occasionally Biden's ahead in those states because Biden's doing so well among older whites. So how does that make sense? I don't know whether it's Trump's, you know, less conventional, so older voters, you know, are used to kind of an older model, or whether it's some of the various cost savings in health care that Biden's tried to achieve or what. But it's very notable.
So I want you to hear just some things. You know, I'd expect people that want Trump to win to say certain things. I expect people that want Biden to win to say certain things. And then Bill Maher, who wants Biden to win, has come to this conclusion. Cut 4.
45% of Hispanic voters prefer Biden compared to 39% for Trump. Last time he won, 59%. That was 2020. So he's lost 14 points there. He went to Morehouse. He said, what is democracy if you have to be 10 times better than anyone else to get a fair shot? That seemed like pandering to me. Black voters under 50. He led by 80 points in 2020, now by 37, still a lot, but he's lost 43 points off the key constituency. Student loans. He's forgiven $144 billion in student loans. Only 36% of student debt holders like it. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you can't win the people you're pandering to, yeah. I mean, I get it. Politics is somewhat about pandering. That's not even an insult. You're supposed to do what people want to a certain degree, also be a leader. But if you're not winning these groups, and he's lost 8% off women since 2020, and yet I read in the polls, he pulled ahead this week. Explain that to me.
Can you, Rich? Because I've said this before. I don't understand it.
Yeah. So the core problem Biden has that's hurting him among everyone is people don't like what he's done on the economy, on inflation, on the border, and they don't think he's strong and effective. So again, to go back to Latinos, the thing with Latinos, you look at them and their attitudes almost match the average voter in the electorate exactly, except for they care a little bit more about the economy, but they care about the border as much, all that. Again, black voters are a little different, and the black voters that Trump is appealing to most are the ones that are least likely to vote. So this will be a major challenge for the Trump campaign. Can they find a way to reach those people continuously and turn them out in November, that's a big challenge. So that's why he's going to overperform among Latinos. I'm absolutely confident that the stuff of the black voters, I need to see it in November to believe in it.
So let's talk about what you expect to see in the debate on Thursday. And you wrote about that. You say Trump could be his own worst enemy as Biden's campaign flounders. Well, how could he be? Just from acting too aggressive? How else could he be? Maybe in an unexpected way?
Well, I mean, and the main thing, don't do what he did in the first debate in 2020, which really hurt him. I was talking to a friend who was in the Trump war room during that debate, and they're all just like pulling their hair out, and it did make a difference. So I think he's been told that. I think he's absorbed that. You know, he said that. It was Hannity. I got to let Biden talk. But the question is, he's so aggressive, right? He's such a natural competitor. He thinks Biden is so contemptuous, contemptible. Can he control himself? You know, more than say half an hour. I think half an hour is going to be absolutely what his folks told him to do. But after that, you know, all bets could be off. And I just don't think Trump needs to prove anything in this debate. I don't think he needs to knock out Biden. I think Biden is ready to fall. But the question is the alternative acceptable? So Trump just needs to be normal, could almost even fade to the background, and I think can win this debate. But again, that's not his natural tendency.
You wrote Trump is in the rare position of a challenger who doesn't need to take down the incumbent president. People are ready to fire Biden, and I think he knows it, which means that maybe is why he's been holed up most of the last 2 weeks.
Yeah, look, I mean, he's lost a step, right? He needs more preparation than the average bear. I think he needs to the extent he can, you know, memorize everything. I think he's going to be highly rehearsed, and that, you know, that might create a tendency on Trump to push him real hard, to try to get him off the rehearsed points. But the problem with that pushing, you know, is potentially going too far. So, you know, this could be a really consequential debate, Brian. I mean, if Biden really slurs his words or, you know, wandering the wrong way, it could be a torpedo to his bow. And then Trump, you know, has this Trump nostalgia going, and he just needs people to continue to give him that second look. But if he, you know, if he acts wild, it could hurt him too.
So I asked the Trump people, why did you accept it? I mean, it doesn't seem like you got anything. I mean, they got to kill the mics. No audience, studio. They got to pick the two moderators that really hate him on CNN, and they're not opinion guys. They're the alleged news people. And they said, because they did this, so we wouldn't accept it. So we said, just accept it. And they thought we were going to back out, and we're not going to back out. So that's why they're in the emergency sessions they're in right now. They never thought the Trump people would accept it. Do you think I'm being spun, or do you think that's how you see it?
Well, I think they wanted the debate. They really wanted the debate because they think Biden is pathetic, which he is, and this can really help Trump, which it could, you know. But it's not necessarily going to play out that way. It's just potential. So the Biden people had the leverage because Biden was talking like, you know, there might not be any debates, and Trump really wanted them. So that gave Biden the leverage. I don't think, you know, these moderators don't like Trump. It would be better if there's an audience. But if Trump's on his game and follows through, you know, a reasonable playbook, which I think he's been given, I don't think any of that necessarily matter. I think he can easily win.
And evidently he's got a lot of lines ready to go. They were going through rehearsals last night just where they sit around, they talk about issues, and they just say, how you handle this, how you handle that. They don't want to stand at podiums and pretend to be Joe Biden. That's not his speed. And they were just shocked at the depth in which he has on these issues because he did the job for 4 years. And also he's got great instincts. He's also has lines ready to go. You know, I went back and watched the debate last night, as I just told our audience. And the one thing that's been misconceived, misremembered, if you go back and look at this, I wrote this down. You know, Joe Biden said, oh, you know, he said, Joe, you don't know what you're talking about. He said those things. But he said this, he said this about Trump. You're a fool when it comes to masks. Told him to shut up three times. He also said, shush up one. He said, you are the worst president we've ever had. He hadn't kidding. He goes, then he said, then he called him a clown. He said, he also said that Trump was a racist. So out of all the harsh words that were coming out, it was actually coming from Joe Biden. And Chris Wallace lost track of the law and order section. He never asked Trump a question because Trump was interrupting and he thought those were Trump's points, but they weren't his points. He was waiting for a question.
Yeah, this is the unfairness of Trump's existence, right? In the media, but also in the public, if there are these harsh exchanges and all this crosstalk, doesn't matter who started it, doesn't matter who says the harshest things or does more crosstalk, Trump will get blamed. And it's not just not just in the media, but in the public perception. So again, that's why I think he needs to be a little more relaxed, and take a chill pill and let some of this stuff wash over him. Again, that's not his nature. Would I predict necessarily he's going to do that? I'm not so sure. But he doesn't need to knock out Joe Biden. He just doesn't. The guy is ready to fall.
Right. And the thing is, they're going to try to say some things that I think everybody knows already. They're going to say the bipartisan bill disqualifies Trump because he didn't go along with it from saying anything about the border. They're going to say, look at what I had to do with the border is working. Well, both those things will give you a wide, leave your chin wide open or your solar plexus is free to counter with. Is he going to have time to do it in 1 minute? And let me ask you, I want people, before I let you go, to hear a little bit about what Jake Tapper has said. And I don't know if you watch or you go on there, but this is what Jake Tapper has said about Trump. Cut two.
President Trump lives in an atmosphere of disinformation. The Trump presidency is coming to an end. For tens of millions of our fellow Americans, their long national nightmare is over. The dehumanizing rhetoric of Adolf Hitler is once again alive and well, this time given life by former president and current Republican presidential frontrunner, Donald Trump.
Yep, there he is. He's going to treat everybody fairly. There shouldn't be a problem.
Yeah, I mean, Jake's a talented guy. And when he was White House correspondent for ABC, I guess it was, before he went over to CNN, he was notably more fair-minded than others. But clearly he's one of these guys where Trump kind of pushed him over the edge and he released just let it hang out. And it will not be a totally fair debate in terms of the moderation. It just won't, But that's kind of a status quo. That's sort of typical for a Republican, and you need to be able to deal with it. And again, I think Trump should be able to deal with it. But the biggest threat to Trump is how Trump himself acts in the debate. If it's reasonable and would strike the average people is reasonable, it's very likely he's going to win, and it'll be a way station to the presidency. If not, it could hurt.
Yeah, I guess we'll see. And right where the election is right now, Trump can't be upset. He's winning almost every battleground state, and he brought New Hampshire and Virginia and Minnesota into play. So that's going to spread out Joe Biden's money even more. Trump might have to defend North Carolina. I got it. But next thing you know, Joe might have to defend New York if it continues like this. It's fascinating. Rich Lowry, that's where we pick up the National Review. I appreciate your insight.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Brian. Enjoy the debate.
It's going to be great. 1-866-408-7669. When we come back, just your debate thought, your thoughts, your big worry, and your prediction of how it's going to, not who's going to win a bet, but how you think it's going to go. Because I'll tell you the format. I'll go into a little bit more detail. I found out a lot of news last night about it. They also sent me over some things that only the campaigns got. I'll share them with you. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hear the ins and outs of the 2024 election right here. The Brian Kilmeade Show. If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
President Biden is not fit.
His time up here has just come and gone, unfortunately. And I don't say that with pride, but that, we all get older. We're not getting any younger.
Look at the way the country's being run right now. Look at everything we're going through. It's a lot better 4 years ago.
Every day seems like he's not confident for the role. As Americans, we should be worried.
We could do better as the Democratic Party. I feel like if someone younger and more fit could come into service, I feel like that would be a huge step in the right direction.
And we'll see. I mean, I'm sure most Democrats, as Charlemagne the God was saying, want anybody but Joe Biden, but he's not moving out of the way. Sure, Governor Whitmer, huge problems. I think she's so overrated. Governor Newsom, all look, no substance, 44% approval rating. Governor Jared Polis, people were telling me he's moderate, but people who live in Colorado said, don't fall for it. He's not. So what were they going to do? They never had a primary. He wouldn't let RFK Jr. run. They wouldn't let anybody else in except for fringe candidates. So you're stuck with Joe Biden. And Barack Obama is desperate to help, evidently. He's going over some things, telling him what the stakes are about, doing some private events, too. So John writes me and says, What will be the viewer's response if the moderator in the debate restrict Trump's responses for a narrow, very narrow scope? This would be like Judge Merchant did with the jury. Also, are there agreements that the moderators will not engage in snotty comments like George Stephanopoulos always does when he tries to negate a point he doesn't like? No, I don't think so. John Zosley from Minnesota. They always are going to do that. What I always love, too, is guys like Marco Rubio and Tom Cotton, especially. What did you just say? We're going back to that. That's not true. When they go, Donald Trump's a liar and everybody knows it. And they'll move on to, but we have to move on to another subject. Those guys will bring it back to something a little bit different. So I thought this was pretty cool, too, is that Donald Trump has responded to the fact that Evan Gorshkovich, the Wall Street Journal reporter, was just in prison over 200 days ago for no reason. He wrote a column, no coincidence, about how bad the Russian economy really is. Then he left Moscow because he's so familiar with the country. His parents were born there, speaks fluent Russian, and had dinner with friends. Then he was arrested as a spy. He's been in jail ever since. They shaved his head. I saw him today. And he's been in jail, and it's going to be hopeless. 4 hours, and now they're going to wait till the middle of August. He says he's reading Russian novels and playing chess by mail with his dad. Brutal. Here's what Trump tweeted, or put on Truth Social. The young Wall Street Journal reporter who's being harshly detained in Russia as his espionage trial is about to begin will be released prior to my taking office if I win the election on November 5th. Crooked Joe can't do anything right, although it's likely he'll pay billions of dollars, which includes a very bad Biden precedent, to get Evan home. I got a record 58 hostages back home. That was mostly Robert O'Brien, paying next to nothing. Putin has no respect for Biden, and that's the way it goes. Fear not, Evan. I will get you home soon, and you'll be safe while there. I figure he could go in and just be absolutely relentless. I know this. I saw General Kellogg, an aide to President Trump, is recommending that Trump backed this deal where he would stop sending weapons to Ukraine and tell the Russians, come right to the peace table. If you come, then they'll stop sending weapons. If you don't come, we'll send even more weapons. I think that's a real dumb idea by a lifetime soldier who's been to Ukraine. But you just can't let the Russians take the greatest assets of Ukraine and try to take more every single year and just say, well, we don't want war, let's end it. No, find a way to get them the weapons they need to win it. And the strategy necessary, because these guys without a navy, the Ukrainians, have basically eviscerated the Russian navy and blowing up Crimea by the day.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moment of the Brian Kilmeade Show. We're back here in Midtown Manhattan, heard around the country, around the world, where you're going to see some video of an attack sometime today that just happened about 6 blocks from where we're at. You have a woman about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, nice dress, just walking down the block. Two guys, masks, of course, they're cowards, with a baseball bat, start beating her. And just to steal her purse, she didn't want to let go of her purse from behind, by the way. I mean, that's what's going on in this city. When you have 67,000 illegal immigrants, if they're not fighting with each other, they're robbing you. And that's a generality, which has become a reality. Great news for us here at the Brian Kilmeade Show. We're adding another great affiliate, KAOI in Hawaii. Station show, it's KLOI, yep. News Talk Sports for Maui and beyond at 1110 a.m. and 96.7 FM. I know a lot of people that moved out to Hawaii. Hopefully you're going to love the show, especially at this great time, which is nighttime. And number two, at this great time, which is election sprint. And now we are hours away from a debate. Bottom of the hour, we're going to talk to Ariel Lightstone, served as senior advisor to U.S. Ambassador David Friedman. He also played a critical role in advancing the Arab Accords. And he's got some opinions about the fracturing U.S.-Israel relations. So a Supreme Court has now actually recorded this ruling. We expect some every day, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday of the next 2 weeks. And here's what it is. A divided U.S. Supreme Court has upheld the ability of the federal government, this is sad, to communicate with social media platforms and the news media about publishing third-party content on controversial or potentially dangerous topics like vaccines, election interference, and terrorism. It was a 6-3 court majority ruling that said the parties challenging the outreach said they did not have standing to pursue their appeal. Two Republican-led states and several private parties had sued, claiming First Amendment violations by the Biden administration, accused of improperly coordinating with tech firms to remove or limit information. So, for example, when you came out and said ivermectin could work, it's okay to shadow ban them. When you came out and just said, you know, ventilators for 30-year-olds, not a great idea with COVID-19. That two masks for 4-year-olds is not good, and then have your account suspended. Or that laptop that Hunter Biden has is real, and have your account suspended. That's allowed. So I don't know if it was the way the type of case it was, but the theory that's being upheld I found depressing. But what I'm really looking forward to is tomorrow night's debate. It's going to be saw on Fox and a simulcast, but it's a CNN-led debate. Ben Vogt is a professor of rhetoric and director of debate and speech at Southern Methodist University over in Dallas and joins us now. Ben, are you looking forward to tomorrow night?
Yeah, I am looking forward to it. I am a great lover of debate. I think it had a lot of potential to help our nation. And so even with all the limitations, I'm excited about tomorrow night's debate.
So we got six sections. Two the Trump team thinks is in their ballpark, which I think is immigration, maybe the economy. And he says the other four are going to be 2020 election. It's going to be about January 6th, global warming type things. Does that mean we're limited to those topics that the moderators pick, or do skilled debaters able to bring us elsewhere?
Yeah, I think the debaters certainly are able to go in other directions. Now, again, it's a little bit ominous in the way that they can turn off the microphone, but I presume that with the time they're given, the debaters can go in different directions. And again, it's pretty crisp, I mean, short amount of time, but I think the debaters are probably well served to go beyond the bounds of what the moderators have set up.
I mean, you can do it, not break the rules. So you could say, yeah, on January 6th, it was a bad day for the country. It was a protest that got out of control. But let me just tell you what the country really cares about. And then you could fill in the blank. You could talk about the economy. Yeah. You could talk about inflation. And you're not breaking the debate, right?
No, I think that's quite right. I think sometimes people get a little bit frustrated about that, but these candidates need to be there for themselves and for their future election and things like that. And I think, just like you pointed out, you know, January 6th is a historical matter. It's not necessarily answering a question about the future. And so the debaters, you know, the candidates, they should talk about what their agenda for the future is. And I think the way you outlined it makes perfect sense. And so I would think they will do that in the debate.
So, Ben, here's what they've told us about the format. And tell me how unique and the challenge of it. Candidate A gets 2 minutes. Candidate B gets 1 minute for rebuttal. And then candidate A gets to rebut the rebuttal. Your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, I do think the rebuttal process is good. I think, on the whole, though, these time limits are too short. I mean, just to kind of give it a historical perspective, when they first started doing these with Kennedy and Nixon in 1960, they had about 6 to 8 minutes
Wow.
to have opening remarks, and there are no real opening remarks for this debate. And so by putting such tight time limits on the candidates, it's really liable to misstatements and missteps because you only have a short amount of time, which conversely, and this is kind of my big complaint about the format, there's not any time limit on the moderators. They can go as long as they want setting up that question and really making an argument, and then the debaters or the candidates here only have, like you're saying, a minute or 2 minutes maximum to answer a potentially very complicated question.
So it's going to be killing the mics. I never really heard of that at a high-level debate. You do this. So they're going to kill the mics, but they're going to leave it in a two-shot. This is the way I understand it. So I'll be able to see the rolling of the eyes, the exasperated look, the pounding of the podium, the frantically jotting stuff down. So I'll be able to interpret what the other one is thinking. That should matter too, right?
Right. And to be honest, that's been a longstanding criticism about these debates. It's kind of a potentially split screen or something where you may see certain reactions as chosen by the network. Now, hopefully the campaigns have kind of put some stipulations on that, but I do think the reactions of the debaters are important and significant, and that's true in college debate when we do it, high school debate, you know, how people react – is informative to those, you know, judging it or, and assessing, like, you know, oh, what does this person say? Like, if your opponent says something untrue, I mean, some sort of reaction is probably warranted to help the audience know, like, oh, okay, this person does not think that is true. And, but yeah, they won't, I guess they won't be able to hear them, but they would be able to see their facial expressions and things like that and the eyes rolling, as you said. I think that's an important factor in the debate.
And Ben, I also heard different people say different things about this. You come up to the 2 minutes, the bell goes off, the people at home see the light go on, almost like a stand-up comic. The red light goes on, you got to get off the stage, or you can lose that reputation. The club owner gets mad at you, and the other comics get mad at you. Now, in this debate, when you hit that stop sign, they say whatever you say next aggravates the viewer or the audience member. Do you find that to be true?
I'm not sure it's quite that severe. I mean, I think it is just a little bit of a lost opportunity when the mic goes off because you're going to miss the parts. But I think it's I'm always telling my debaters, you know, it's kind of good to run to the tape, as we say, like that you show the audience like that you want to talk, that you have things to say, and, you know, that if you were given more time, you know, you would keep talking. So I don't think it's all bad, but typically, again, like in high school and college debate, there would be a little bit of grace where, like, you would go like maybe 10 seconds or, you know, maybe 15 seconds maximum to complete a sentence or something. But it's an interesting question because they will have these mic cutoffs, and I suspect they'll be pretty sharp.
Right. And the other thing is, let's be realistic. We know how these mics work. You can hear in the background. Sometimes you can hear floor directors on our show. They'll say something like, rap, you know, we got to get out of here, or next guest, or you'll hear them overreact to what's in their headset. So you'll be able to hear, say, oh, you're a liar. That's not true. The stuff from the first debate. So that'll play a role in it. When you watch back the first debate, or what you remember of it, or the second one, what is unique to these two? What bothered you most, or what would you say about their style that'll give you an idea how this one will go?
Well, I think the legendary one was the first debate in 2020. I mean, they were interrupting each other so much that it was very difficult to interpret. And I think almost everybody is apprehensive that there's going to be a repeat of that. In fact, that is what led to the mic cutoff rule, which was just to try to, limit the amount of over talking, so you really literally couldn't tell what either one of them were saying because they were talking so much. And there's so much emotional energy here with, you know, Trump and Biden have both said pretty intense things to each other over the last few months, and now they're finally on the stage together. But my biggest complaint about all of this is that I think the moderator roles are so unregulated and aggressive that it adds more emotional energy and risk of the kind of overtalk that they say they're trying to stop. If these people had actually more time to speak, and I would even urge like an opportunity to cross-examine each other directly, like, well, why can't Biden ask Trump a question? Why can't Trump ask Biden a question? Why can't the moderators kind of sit a little more out? Yeah, and I think they should, and hopefully they will, because I mean, there's really nothing to preclude them from raising that, you know, in the course of the time that they have to speak.
So you give up your time. You say, well, Joe, let me ask you, what have you done at the border? You know, tell me what, why have you not done this executive order, which is so great? Why didn't you do it earlier? And you might decide, rather than say, this is what I did, you might say, let's just get this on. Let's find out. What did you do? Why don't you tell me? Why don't you name, Joe, why don't you name these three women that have been brutally raped and killed over the last 3 weeks? Can you name one of them? So that's a choice that I'll have to do with my minute. I could do what I want, I imagine.
Yeah, I think that is a very interesting possibility. I noticed that in the 2020 vice presidential debate, I thought that Pence made a smart move on Kamala Harris, where he kind of did that, interrupted his speech and said, I want to know from you, Kamala, if you're going to pack the court. And she really was kind of befuddled by that and had a hard time answering. And I think it set that issue up high. It's like, oh, we need to think about how would the Supreme Court be treated by, you know, different candidates. So I think that would be a smart move by the candidates to try to cross-examine their opponents, and that's a very common staple of, I would say, ideal debate.
What does it say about what you expect when it's, and how unique is it when a sitting president takes most of the last 10 days to study for a debate?
Well, I think it gives you a sense of its importance and its potential to affect the outcome of this coming election in a significant way. I mean, I think one of the ways to look at this debate event is just from a viewership standpoint. There is a high probability that the viewership of this is going to be 50 to 80 million people, which is 10 times larger than what people tuned in for, like the NHL finals for hockey or the NBA finals between the Celtics and the Mavericks. I mean, this is 10 times bigger than most really popular television shows. And so, yeah, I think President Biden probably wise, both of them are wise. This is going to be way bigger than the conventions are for them. And so the miscues and the statements that are here are going to be replayed again and again and again. And I think for Biden especially, I think this is a bit of a challenge to secure his nomination at the convention. I mean, I think he is trying to make sure that the Democrats feel comfortable in Chicago that, like, he really should be the nominee. So I think the stakes are significant for both of them, but I'm not surprised that Biden, you know, is taking a lot of time to try to prep this.
Ben Vogt's with us, professor at SMU, director of debate and rhetoric there and speech. So he's giving us an insight about what goes into this. This is what bothered the Trump camp. I spoke to him last night. They said, okay, got 2 minutes, then 1 minute for a rebuttal to the rebuttal. And then at the discretion of the moderators, 1 minute for clarification. And that's what worries the Trump people, because they saw how Jake Tapper and Dana Bash, especially over the last 3.5 years and most of the years when Trump was in office, how they really have outward disdain, my words, outward angst about Trump. And the way they've acted, and I could play a myriad of clips. They're worried about that discretion. Do they have a reason to worry?
Oh, absolutely. No, and I don't think it's wrong for the Trump campaign to be concerned about the moderators, Bash and Tapper, that have a clear history of hostility to the Trump campaign. And as I've been saying in my research for years, is that there is an expansive role being taken by these journalistic moderators that they used to occupy less than 10% of the speaking time. The last one that we had, the moderator, Chris Wallace, went over 25% of the speaking time. And so when you talk about the discretion that these moderators have, it's a pretty hazardous thing. And what really needs to happen in order for these debates to perform more correctly and ideally for the public is, like I'm saying, is to rein in these moderators, have rules that basically say, like, hey, you can't take more than 10% of the debate time with whatever logistical things you're doing. But, yeah, this discretion that they have about clarification, it's going to be very much rooted in their subjectivity about what they think is true or untrue vis-a-vis Trump and Biden. And if they think that Biden's being treated unfairly, they're going to say, well, you know, President Biden, would you like to clarify your remarks? And that's not fair. That's not the nature of a debate where there's an optional speech, you know, at the discretion of the judge or the adjudicator. So, yeah, that is bad form. And I could understand, you know, the Trump campaign being concerned about that.
And lastly, what I don't get is, and I don't know how to answer this, is the fact check. So when I was watching DeSantis and Gavin Newsom, I don't really know inside out of California politics, you know, the reality on their immigration or migration and housing costs. I don't have it memorized. I don't have Florida's memorized either. And they were both accusing the other of other things. And I'm sitting to myself like, when are we going to get a fact check? Is it possible? Have you ever seen a debate format where people are checking the facts in real time? Real quick, 20 seconds.
That does happen in the form of the cross-examination for debaters, and that's why I'm saying the best form of fact check would be to let the debaters check each other. I think, again, to let these journalists do it is actually not good. This is something that started way back with Candy Crowley, like in 2012. It's very difficult to do live fact check.
Ben, thanks so much. You have a prediction?
I think that this will probably help the Trump campaign a little bit more than Biden, but I think it's going to be close.
Go get him, Ben. Thanks so much for your insight. We appreciate it.
You're welcome, Brian. Thanks for the invite.
You got it. 1-866-408-7669. Gave you a lot to think about, so I want to hear from you. And then bottom of the hour, Aria Lightstone, the latest on the Middle East, another place in which President Biden has totally screwed up.
Expanding your knowledge base. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. 1-866-408-7669. Then again, I hope to hear get my first call from Hawaii today, from Maui. K-A-O-I, now aboard. Thanks, guys. Here's Cody on WXJB in Florida. Hey, Cody.
Hey, Brian.
What's on your mind?
Hey, man, I just had an idea. I don't know if I'm sure some of the viewers have seen the movie 8 Mile with Eminem, where he's in his final rap battle. And, you know, he's going against his competitor. Right off the bat, he comes out and he says everything that his rap battle opponent is going to say about him. I think Trump should come out, address the American people, say, listen, this man, Joe Biden, he's going to call me a racist. He's going to call me a liar. He's going to call me this. He's going to call me a convicted felon. This is all he has. And basically take the wind, you know, straight out of the sails of the Biden campaign, because you know that's what they're going to come out and do. They're going to call him names. So if off the bat, he basically says everything that he's going to call him, he basically will end the debate right there as far as Joe Biden being able to come out and name call and do all that. So
that would be interesting. Like, it's definitely worth a line, Cody, to take it away from him and kind of throw him off. Hey, you're going to call me a racist, and you're going to say I'm a convicted criminal, and you're going to say I'm the worst president, blah, 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 and, like, name the nine things, right? And they say, okay, go ahead. You want to just go do it, get it over with? Because people out there don't care. They know what kind of president I am, and they know what kind of president you are, and they know who they want to do it again.
Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
4 months ago, there has been a dramatic decline in arms supplies from the U.S. to Israel. In light of what I've heard in the past 24 hours, I hope and believe that this matter will be resolved soon.
That is interesting. It's not going to be resolved soon. We're talking about what's happening over in Israel, Gaza, Hezbollah. Where one of the reports said the Taliban reporting to help out the Hezbollah. Isn't that nice? What could go wrong with putting the Taliban back in charge of Afghanistan? And then in Gaza, they said don't go into Rafah. But how do you expect to win the war and not go into Rafah? They're beginning to go in. And, of course, maybe things are slowing down. We got the prime minister making a comment that the strength of the offensive will level off in the next few weeks. We'll have to see how that goes. But it seems as though the Israelis feel they have to push Hezbollah back. Hezbollah is banking on the fact that they could keep, that the U.S. would keep Israel from invading Lebanon. I don't know how that's going to work. What is the truth? The truth is it's an absolute mess. And this is the biggest threat to Israel's existence, maybe since 1948. Aria Lightstone served as the senior advisor to U.S. Ambassador David Friedman over in Israel from 2017 to 2021, played a critical role in the advancing the Abraham Accords, which they're trying desperately to get back on track. Aria, welcome back.
Thank you, Brian. How are you?
Good. We have a lot to discuss. First off, the prime minister's announcement a couple of days ago that the large-scale portion of the war in Gaza is going to begin to level off and pull back. Do you think that's a head fake?
No, I think it's mostly true. I think it's mostly true because it's tied to your other comment that the United States of America has not given Israel the weapons that it needs to win both in Gaza and in the north against Hezbollah. And they now have to prioritize the north, and the south will come down to limited engagements, unfortunately.
Wow. So when we deny it, the Secretary of State denies it, the Secretary of Defense denies it, all upset at the prime minister. But bottom line is the prime minister is telling the truth.
Yet, not only is he telling the truth, Senator Cotton has come out pretty distinctly and described the path of slowing up weapons. And within politics, you can say almost anything you want and twist it how you want. The answer is that they have not slowed down the weapon delivery. What they have not done is they have not rushed the weapon delivery. So they're delivering on the same speed that they were prior to the war, which means at their own pace. Israel is in the middle of a war with enormous needs that has gone on longer than anybody anticipated. And what Israel needs from their number one ally, the United States of America, is to rush them the weapons that they need in order to win in a quick and decisive fashion.
So I thought that Israel, to an extent, can manufacture their own weapons. If so, what can they do on their own? What do they need us for?
So in this global environment, You can manufacture much of your own weapon, but if you can't complete 100% of that weapon, or you can't complete the smart weapons, and this is the greatest irony, the smart bombs that enable Israel to target specific terrorists and to mitigate or perhaps minimize all civilian damages, that's what the United States of America is holding back. So Israel has the ability to manufacture, quote, dumb bombs on its own, but not at the speed that they need to in order to be able to handle a two-front war. We've known since the Ukraine war has started that the entire world, at least the Western world, has a shortage of armaments. To be able to have two full force wars going on at the same time, the West has not ramped up their efforts. I know President Trump would have enacted the Defense Act, which would have given all of our allies the weaponry that it needs. Right now, we don't have, as the United States of America, enough weapons. We certainly have not supplied enough to Ukraine and certainly not to Israel.
What was so offensive from the Biden administration that they said the prime minister is basically speaking out of school? He's not telling the truth. But I think they were more offended that the truth got out.
Absolutely. The Biden administration has a goal prior to the election, which is to bring down the Bibi Netanyahu government. And to think that that would be a goal of ours against an ally is just insane. But it explains an enormous amount of the policy decisions that Team Biden has made.
So I understand, if these reports are correct, this is called an Italian strike in European Union circles. And that is the slow walking of weapons that was happening because of different reasons with Ukraine. But a lot of it has to do with the fact that Joe Biden does not ever explain his methods, never explains goals, short-term, long-term, never explains what he's up to and the reason for America to stay involved, to sell his cause, like you have to do as a president, whether you agree or not. You got to be telling me all the time, what are we doing? What's the goal? What's your concern? But instead, we have an ongoing Ukraine situation and people paying a political price for the support. So there's waning interest. And now in Israel, we're seeing the protests here at home, the anti-Semitism, the pro-Hamas attitudes, the Yasser Arafat dress-up kit that we're watching handed out all across America. That's what he's responding to. And get this, Aria, I heard this started in December. In December of this year came the slow walking of weapons.
That's absolutely correct. The slow walking weapons has occurred after the first initial rush that the United States of America brought on the week of October 8th, when they ran out some of the replacement equipment that was destroyed in the first onslaught by Hamas. I'm sorry, they're testing an emergency broadcast system here, and that has my kids terrified because it reminds them of all the times that they run down to the shelter. So I'm watching my kids.
Where are you?
The basement now. Right now, I'm in New Jersey. So it just goes to show you what winds up happening over here. I'm like, kids, there's no bomb shelter in the basement, and there's nobody actually shooting rockets at you right now. But I apologize for the ambient noise. This has gone on since December, and the worst part about all of this is that we have American hostages sitting in tunnels under Hamas. And since December, the policy of the Biden administration has been ceasefire, not get our hostages back, but stop shooting at the enemy, which in of itself is just ridiculous.
We just saw some video yesterday or the day before, hard to remember, of one of the hostages, American Israeli hostages, who was beat up, thrown at the back of a truck with the bone of his arm sticking out, being picked up by the hair to show his face to the camera. What's the purpose of that?
It's intimidation. This is that they are terrorists, and what they are trying to do is to create terror. Every single kid in Israel has seen that picture. Every single kid, when they get recruited into the army, has seen that picture. Every single kid, when they're 14 years old, before they go to sleep at night, has seen that picture. The goal of terrorism is to create terror, and that's why they wore GoPros. That's why they promoted all of their films. I want to be very clear about this. Terrorists are going to commit terror. That I have no issue. I mean, I have issue with terrorism, but I understand where terrorists are coming from because they're the very worst part of society. The fact that Western culture has sat here and said that they did not commit these crimes, that they are peaceful freedom fighters, when they are showing you exactly who they are, that makes no sense. And that is a danger to our society in ways that we can't even comprehend.
And by the way, I want to get to the actual tactics of going into Lebanon and the challenges. But for people to say two-state solution, Bernie Sanders, we have two-state solution. Yeah, okay. Do you know that they don't want a two-state solution? Do you know there's nobody that wants a two-state solution? The Palestinians go, I want everything. And the Israelis say, well, keep what we have. The two-state solution is dead by the people involved. What is that? When you hear people call for that, what are you thinking of someone who got their hands dirty for 4 years in this conflict?
Yeah, well, I think that they're just not very intelligent. I think that there are two types of people who try to do stuff in the Middle East, people who want to accomplish things and people who want a virtue signal. Let's use a great example of that. President Biden built a pier to go to Gaza with your and my taxpayer
$450 million. Oh, okay.
Exactly right. How much aid was delivered from that pier?
Almost nothing.
Zero. Zero. $0. Because everybody knew, just imagine this, the general sat around the table and told President Biden, or even worse, did not tell President Biden, this will not resolve the problem. But President Biden's political handler said, I need to announce this at the State of the Union. So rather than care about fixing a problem, let's figure out how we can virtue signal. That's what the two-state solution is. Let's virtue signal. There's not a single human being alive who believes that the two-state solution would actually work. Not Palestinian, not Israeli, certainly not American who has any common sense. But it is a virtue signal is what it is.
But they want to blame Netanyahu for not signing on to it. It's a joke.
Of course.
So I want you to hear what General Jack Keane, I know you respect, talks about what the Israelis will be getting there, getting involved in if they, of course, go ahead with going into Lebanon.
What Israeli is looking at doing is pushing Hezbollah back across a river in Lebanon, referred to as Litani River. Mm-hmm. It's about 18 miles from the Israeli border. Push all of their military capability back there. They would also have to push the citizens of southern Lebanon back beyond that river as well. They have two choices, Mike. They can try to do that with an air campaign, or they can do it with an air and ground campaign. This is not easy to do. In 2006, they were doing much the same in Lebanon, and after several weeks, they retreated out of there, essentially a failed operation. They did air and ground at that time. All service chiefs were relieved as a result of this operation's outcome. So, but nonetheless, the Israelis know full well if they don't do something about returning their settlers to Israel's northern sector, the fact is then Israel has a new border. And that is unacceptable to them.
See, people don't understand. The status quo is not okay.
Status quo is unsustainable. There are 100,000 Israeli citizens who have now been living in hotels for the last 9 months. That is an entire family into one hotel room. These aren't the Ritz-Carltons. These are not Days Inns. They are below that. Imagine what that does to the family structure. Imagine when the father is away in reserves, the mother doesn't have job because they're now 50 miles away from their own community and the kids aren't in their regular schools. This is destroying the fabric of society, and the fact that Israel doesn't have the ability to allow their citizens to live in their own homes with security is a basic failure of what any government is supposed to provide. So Israel will act. Now, I'll respectfully disagree with what the general said. This cannot be accomplished through the air alone. It's not at all possible. It will require ground troops. And what it will require is a devastating victory on behalf of the Israeli army, or what will happen in 2 years from now. The Hezbollah will come back to the border and perpetrate the same exact crimes that they're perpetrating today.
As will Hamas on the south. And here's the thing.
Exactly correct.
That's only going to get worse because these drones that they're using are beginning to penetrate the Iron Dome and your other missile systems. Yep. So something's got to happen. They're doing this on a regular basis. I know you guys know this. So you need all hands on deck, not only with your fighters, but your scientists, correct? Your engineers.
Yeah, the innovation that is coming out of this is absolutely incredible. If you look at some of the professors from West Point who have studied what Israel's been able to accomplish in Gaza, this will be taught for the next 30 years in terms of combating urban warfare and underground warfare. And with all of the ingenuity that's going on, Israel still has not figured out how to find the arch enemy of Hamas. And I'm not positive they've been able to pinpoint the arch enemies of Hezbollah yet either.
Are you worried about the anti-Semitism in this country? Were you as shocked as I was when it showed its ugly head and continues to do this?
I'm shocked based upon the lack of universal condemnation. I'm not shocked that it exists. And I got to be honest with you, I'd rather know my enemy publicly. The fact that the squad has been saying these things from Congress. To get elected to Congress, there should be a bar that you have to leap over in terms of who you are. It is a representative body. When they get elected, they are representing people who feel the way that they do. When Ilhan Omar got up and said it's all about the Benjamins and was not condemned for anti-Semitism, she was condemned for Islamophobia. Jamal Bowman, who was elected out last evening, to me is the American people coming up and saying, we do not believe in this garbage and we're going to stand up against this garbage. What I am not surprised about is how destroyed our college campuses are. This has been going on for decades, and it needs to be fixed or the fabric of the United States of America will ultimately rot from within.
Real quick, I'm against the break, but do you think that the curriculum could change rapidly because the donors on these elite at these elite schools are going to be cutting off the funding? Federal government, if the government should change, they're going to be examining all this funding, whether they should be getting these grants or not. Do you think that'll change could change things in terms of what's being taught?
Not with the donors. The endowments are too large. People are not responsive to donors anymore. If the federal government follows the laws that are on the books, whether it's masking or educational curriculum, that can change things. Short of leadership from the White House, our elite universities will continue to be a hotbed for anti-Semitism.
All right, Lightstone, thanks so much. Would you go back if Trump wants you back?
If the president of the United States of America asked me to serve, it would be my highest privilege and honor to do so.
All right, let's see if he wins in November. I'm sure he'll call you. All right, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Brian.
When we come back, I call you. You call me. 1-866-408-7669. You're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't forget, One Nation. I know it's only Tuesday. One Nation coming up Saturday. Got a huge show for you, including Douglas Murray is going to be with us to put this all in perspective. He is right now in Israel coming back here to join me in studio.
You're with Brian Kilmeade. The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back. One of the many sports stories going on, one of the things that matters a lot in this region, it'll matter mostly next year in the playoffs, but NBA's pretty hot right now. The Knicks have added Mikal Bridges. He's a teammate of Villanova. Wildcats, fellow teammates Josh Hart and Brunson, as well as DiVincenzo. So I've never seen it. Five players reuniting as pros, and they're good, and they play great together. And watching a team being assembled without superstars, that's what sports is supposed to be. But on the other side, you have teams who still want to just take their talents to different places and win. And the guy who's done that, LeBron James, and unintentionally, I'm sure, he thinks he's bigger than the game. And when he became a free agent, went to Miami, decides to go back to Cleveland, then he decides he wants to go to Los Angeles. He wants to bring superstar friends with him, and he becomes bigger than the GM, bigger than the franchise, bigger than the other players. They eat up all the cap, and they have just also rans with them. Jordan never maxed out the cap. He wanted everybody to get paid and wanted to have the best talent possible. But J.J. Redick, a great player in his day, fantastic college player. He has a podcast with LeBron, and because of that, he got himself the coaching job in Los Angeles. And listen to how he handles his critics. The guy has no coaching experience. I'm sure with Coach K and all the great coaches he has, he's a fantastic broadcaster right away. I'm sure he'll be fine. But a lot of people say he's got no experience. Why are you giving the Laker job? Cut 40.
What misconceptions or concerns about you that you've heard in the last few weeks are you the most looking forward to dispelling when you're the coach?
It's a valid question. And I've certainly heard everything. It's been a really interesting 6 weeks or so, just in terms of, being part of the engagement farming industry. You know, it's been really interesting. However, I don't really have a great answer for your question because I really don't give a f-. Like, honestly, I want to coach the Lakers. I want to coach the team. I don't want to dispel anything. I don't. I want to become a great coach in the NBA, and I want to win championships, and I want my players to maximize their careers. That's all I care about.
Okay. So we know after doing these games on broadcast television for the last 2 years, he's emerged as one of their top analysts, really comfortable. He knows not to curse. Can't curse. Why was he doing that? I mean, what's going on between that, Jamal Bowman the other day, AOC? We see it all the time. And I just think, you know, with the screaming out of the State of the Union, I think it's part of it. You should not be doing that. I mean, the nonstop cursing. And then you have a guy with the Lakers. He has this great moment. And by the way, you know what your answer was? Just what you said. By going out there, becoming a great coach and maximizing the player's abilities, you'll actually dispel all those people who said you can't coach and you can't develop players with no experience. That's your answer. You get easy on the F word. We all hear it, but there's appropriate times and inappropriate times. Brian Kilmeade.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show, Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Excited to be here. Here we are in Debate Eve. A lot going on today. I'm just Capitol Hill, they're really earning their pay. I mean, I'd like to write down a few things that are happening. They're not necessarily headline news, but I think that you care about. And I wrote down like six things. The House GOP had a weekly presser. I picked up some of that. Not that controversial, but got some tough questions. Dems followed up with theirs. Now, the Trump campaign, not Donald Trump, is holding a Black American business leaders roundtable in a barbershop, leaders barbershop in a roundtable in Atlanta, Georgia. Again, going after the African-American vote, they're relentless. The House Judiciary Subcommittee is meeting on radio music and copyrights, 100 years of inequity for recording artists. It is 100% true. I know you think everybody's rich who writes a song. You're not going to believe what a short end of the stick they're getting from these record companies. And they have no power because they got to get signed by these companies to make it. Usually they have no money. They're waitering tables. They're working on farms, trying to break in. I've been bringing this up before with some big time people in country music, and they're afraid of coming out and then alienating themselves. So this hearing could be big, and then Speaker Johnson leads a panel discussion on, drumroll please, protecting women's rights in sports with Virginia Fox and the U.S. Secretary, former U.S. Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos. Why? Because men are trying to, are pretending to be women and going into men's sports, women's sports. Also, special thanks to Maui's own, KAOI, 1110 AM and 96.7 FM, they are now carrying the Brian Kilmeade Show in Hawaii. I think we have to have a market visit before we get to Republican strategists and the president of the O'Donnell and Associates to look at different strategies for the debate tomorrow night. Let's get to the big three.
Now with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
Unfortunately, we see a great deal of violence committed by illegal immigrants, and we see as many victimized by other illegals and regular people here. So it's an enormous problem. This was bound to happen.
That is Kim Ogg. She is with America's Newsroom. And here we go. Death and destruction at the border, and more criminals pour into it and more innocents die. Both parties blame each other. I blame President Biden.
Number two.
You know Jamal Bowman ain't going nowhere, right? Because there's a lot of other seats to run for. You know what I'm saying?
Right. Classy. That's how you do your concession speech, screaming at a rally with a microphone in your hand in a T-shirt and using the F-bomb. Primary day results. So the squad loses a radical soldier in Jamal Bowman. You just heard him, as he is humiliated by a moderate in double figures. Could Cori Bush over in St. Louis be next as presidential VP stakes heat up, with the VP shortlist getting a little bit larger?
Number one.
And points to some of the strategy likely behind trying to have this debate so early in the election year. No matter what happens on Thursday, both sides will have some time to try to, you know, change those polls and get back in the lead before November.
Maybe that's Steph Knight of Axios. Debate day one, a day, debate day is one date away. Inside of the Trump game plan, while President Biden spends days drilling behind closed doors. Why would a sitting president need this kind of prep? I think we know. Let's bring in Brett O'Donnell, Republican strategist and president of O'Donnell and Associates. Brett, I think the Trump team is pretty confident that their guy is ready to go. Should they be?
Well, Brian, they should be. First of all, President Trump has the truth on his side. The economy, immigration, the world, almost every substantive issue that you can think of was better under Donald Trump's leadership than it is under Joe Biden's. And so, you know, I'm interested to see how in the world Joe Biden defends his record in this debate. And I hope that one of the things Donald Trump does is litigate through that record and continue to prosecute the case that, look, things are a lot worse than they were when I was president. And I think if he makes us a referendum on Joe Biden in the debate, he's going to have a good night.
So I watched Andrew Cuomo come out and basically say, as former AG and governor of New York, the only reason that Donald Trump got charged with those 34 counts is because his name was Donald Trump. And I never would have done it if I was AG. Now, I know he's trying to get back in the good graces and run for mayor. I get it. But I think a lot of people feel that way. I don't think the Biden people feel that way, because I think they're going to be saying convicted felon. They've already running ads about that. So when he comes out and says it like I expect, how does Trump absorb that?
Look, I think it's a huge mistake for Biden to make that argument. First of all, this issue's only helped President Trump. He raised a record amount of money off of it. It strengthens his poll numbers, because I think most people are pretty fair when it comes to looking at issues, and they think this is markedly unfair to President Trump. They see it for what it is. It's the weaponization of our justice system. And if Donald Trump faces this argument, I wouldn't play tit for tat with him and, you know, talk about Biden's son. I would just come back at him on the substantive issues. I'd say, you know, look, I know this is what you want to talk about, because you can't talk about the economy. You can't talk about our broken border. You can't talk about the fact that two wars have started while you've been president. You can't talk about how unsafe our streets are. So I'd stick to substance and let that charge roll off my back.
And the thing is, you can absorb and you can parry. So January 6th was a terrible day. And is it true that you're trying to fix the you're trying to get all those January 6th convicted, those people who took plea deals and went to jail, you're trying to get them all out of prison? Are you going to pardon them? You could say, I'm going to take this case by case. But I will say this. The issue right now facing the American people is the border. We just had a 12-year-old girl beaten up for 2 hours, raped brutally, and then strangled to death. Not a word from the White House. Just a study time at Camp David. So you could do both, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. The president has, if he learns the art of the pivot, which I think he knows well.
He does, yeah.
Guy,
he does.
Has done television. He knows what the big issues are. And if he just will pivot to the things that matter to the American people, he can point at Joe Biden and say, look, I know you want to attack me. I know you want to try to get under my skin. You know, I know that this is what they've coached you to do. But let me tell you, this is the stuff that matters to the American people. You know, it matters, by the way, Joe Biden, that your DOJ cares more about going after grandmas on January 6th than it does going after pro-Hamas terrorist sympathizers who are anti-Semitic harassing Jewish synagogue members out in L.A. It matters more than going against or going after folks who have been harassing Supreme Court justices and violating federal it matters more than going after criminals, you know, and so keep pivoting back to substance.
So just to show you the other side, Francesca Chambers, who's on Brett Baer's panel last night, said this about what the Biden people are thinking. Cut 10.
The president's allies see an upside for them here. They believe that the contrast that would be shown on the debate stage between him and Donald Trump will be in their favor. Obviously, they would not have agreed to do this if they did not think that. By the way, both campaigns seem to think that the contrast will work for them. We'll see what happens. But in terms of coming out of the debate and how much Americans will stay tuned into it, the 4th of July is coming up.
But it's your thoughts about being this early and what she said about the Biden people feeling they're going to come out of this as the mature one in the room.
Listen, if this campaign were between two regular candidates, I think this early would be bad. But I think there's high interest in this debate. Look, everyone knows neither of these candidates like each other. They want to watch and see if it's going to be like the train wreck that was the first debate, or if Donald Trump can debate like he did in debate two, stay disciplined and focused. And then actually, you know, most folks haven't heard either of these candidates frame the race, because they haven't. You know, first of all, Joe Biden barely does any events, and Donald Trump's events don't get covered that much by the mainstream media. This will be the first time that both of these folks have a chance to make their case to the American people about why they should be president of the United States. Normally, that happens in the conventions, but this debate happens before the conventions. So it's a very significant event, and the media is going to cover this event like crazy. And so people will read, see, and hear about it.
So, Brett, a lot of interest. Brett, you helped Mitt Romney get ready for his debates, right?
I helped George W. Bush, Mitt Romney, John McCain, Lindsey Graham, others, and two British prime ministers, for that matter, too. So
Mitt Romney came out and just killed it in the first one. And they even mocked him. They mocked Barack Obama on SNL. He was catatonic. He had no answers. He was not used to being debated. He was used to being worshipped. And George W. Bush was helping his brother with a hurricane, was barely even studying for John Kerry, and he got beat up on, and Kerry just catapulted in that race. So Joe Biden, if he was 50 years old, I would say he's looking to avoid that. But I think it's a little different. Tell me what you think about this. I was speaking to one of the highest-ranking Trump people last night, and I said, why did you accept these terms? Why did you accept CNN debate? Why didn't you demand a Fox debate? Why now? And he said, because they didn't think we would accept it. They gave us these severe criteria, wanted us to push back and say then we were going to be scared about it. And the president, former president, said, do it, sign it, let's do it. And that's why they are blitzing this behind closed doors, because they never thought they'd be at this moment. What do your sources say? What is your theory on it?
Well, my theory of the case is that the president should, President Trump should have taken this debate. It should be anytime, any place, which is what he has said publicly. Why? Because even if Joe Biden makes a gaffe, he can't defend his record. He's got a terrible record. More Americans think President Biden has failed on almost every substantial policy issue than has been a success. So he's got a record he can't defend. And let's test President Biden. I think we should have high expectations, by the way. The guy's the president of the United States. He's asking for another term. We should have high expectations for him. And if he doesn't meet those expectations, it'll be a failure. And it could reshape the narrative of this race substantially.
And let me just tell you,
I think it was good for them to take the rules.
And by the way, I've
talked to those folks. I've talked to sources inside the Trump campaign. Anytime, any place for them.
And when you say that, you have to follow through. So that's a good point. When you say anytime, anywhere, and you go, oh, just not there, that's a problem. I get it.
Exactly.
So the New York Times did a poll yesterday on the battleground states. Trump plus one in Wisconsin, Trump plus two in Michigan, Trump plus two in Pennsylvania, plus four in Nevada, plus three in Arizona, plus four in Georgia, plus five in North Carolina. I saw two other polls that I'm dead heat in Minnesota and Virginia. How could you not feel confident if you're in the Trump people?
Exactly. But somehow the Biden people tried to spin that as we've got momentum. I don't know how you spin it that way. It's a close race because there's those margins are tight in every state, but he's winning in every state and close in states that we haven't won in several cycles. So, absolutely. You'd want to go out and try to knock him off early. And so, that's why I think so many folks will tune in. And I think it's smart strategy on the part of the Trump campaign. I'm frankly shocked that Joe Biden is stepping in the debate arena with Donald Trump. I didn't think he would do it.
I watched it back last night. I mean, I think Trump did interrupt, no doubt about it. They just pointed out to me, they did a stat that usually 10% of the time we had last hour, we had a debate expert on who studied the last few debates over at SMU. And they said, on the average, moderators take 10% of the verbiage in a debate. Do you know Chris Wallace, who's very experienced at it, took 23%. And that's part of an upcoming trend that the moderators are making them too much a part of the story. I mean, I hope these two egos who have been vehemently anti-Trump don't see this themselves as a career-defining moment, because it'll be a career-destroying moment, as if being on CNN isn't bad enough. And lastly, on the VP debate, I also spoke to my sources yesterday, and I said, listen, I'm going to go do Doug Burgum to interview, do a profile with him and his wife on Sunday in North Dakota. And he, Rubio, and J.D. Vance are considered the finalists. And I said, do you consider that the finalists? And they came back and said, until today. And I said, what happened? He said, the president just woke up today and just said, can't stop talking about Tim Scott, how much he likes him, how great a job he's been doing, and what a great messenger he is. And I said, okay, looks like that shortlist has been expanded. Your thoughts about Brett O'Donnell's shortlist?
Yeah. So I think, first of all, I think that Republicans have an extremely deep bench. So I think there's a lot of good folks that he could pick from. I think added to that list should be people like Tom Cotton, Mike Pompeo. Those are all very, very sound choices, any of whom would do very well against Kamala Harris in the debate. I think the president, if I was looking, and I've been through this with other presidential campaigns, when you're looking to pick your vice presidential candidate, really you should look at two big things. First of all, will people believe that person is ready to be president of the United States if something happens to the president? And second, can they go win the debate against the vice presidential candidate from the other side and be a great attack dog for the campaign for the rest of their time associated with it? Those are the two criteria that I would use. You know, who's really good on media? Who's going to really skewer Kamala Harris? And who looks like a person who could be president should something happen to the president? Those are the two really important qualities.
Great job, Brett. I want to get your post-game analysis. Friday would be great if you're available. And that'll be excellent. And by the way, I think Tom Cotton does belong in that circle. And I think Mike Pompeo, too. But I don't think Mike Pompeo has been too aggressive with Trump or offering services, not being a critic, but just laying out. So I'm not sure that at this point he's seriously considering him. Brett, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Good to talk to you, Brian.
Same here. So we have a lot to talk about, and I see you up there, and I know everyone's curious. It's like the big day before the Super Bowl. The second debate's not going to matter as much. Even after the convention, this is the first time ever before the first convention. So I want to hear your thoughts next on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Covering this election year like no other, it's Brian Kilmeade. The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
All right, real quick, let's go to the phones. John, listen to WVGA in Valdosta, Georgia. Hey, John.
Hey, Brian, how you doing? I'm a huge fan. Love to listen to you as much as I can.
I appreciate it. Your station's been great for us. Thanks so much. What do you think we should keep in mind for tomorrow night, in your mind?
Well, one thing you mentioned earlier was Trump asking questions of Biden. And I truly believe you don't want to tee a ball up like that. As much as you and I agree on what's going on at the border, you don't want to let Biden come up with 12 positive things that are going on at the border. Trump can ask the question, but he has to keep the ball in his court and answer it himself.
Unless he did something like this, John. Hey, could you name the three women lost their lives due to illegals at the border? Can you name any one of them?
He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. We're waiting on, I think, 17 more Supreme Court decisions. I forgot. It's a lot. Everyone's focused on the immunity. And does the president have immunity from all charges when they're in office because they're doing the country's business? And, of course, that relates to Donald Trump because of January 6th, he was in office. And if he took those documents and it's a problem, he did it while he was in office. So is he immune from that, or is there a degree of immunity which would definitely affect two of the big cases that Jack Smith is hanging his hat on? Joining us now to discuss the one decision that was made today and more is Andy McCarthy. Andy, welcome back.
Brian, how are you?
I'm doing great. Hey, first off, just to maybe you could help me with this, I'm trying to interpret it while doing the show, but a divided U.S. Supreme Court upheld the ability of the federal government to communicate with social media platforms and the news media about publishing third-party content on controversial, potentially dangerous topics like vaccines, election interference, and terrorism. Where does this stem from? The court ruled 6-3, but in layman's terms, when Twitter, when Facebook and social media platforms combined to shadow ban or ban people that brought up things like ivermectin as a cure, that masks might not work, that other people should be suspended for challenge other doctors from challenging other doctors, this lawsuit was brought forward and the Supreme Court said, no, government can do it, right?
Not really. The court decided the case, Brian, on the basis of standing. And I've been reading Justice Barrett's opinion for the majority. So the court's not saying that the people who complained did not suffer an injury, and they're not saying that the social media companies didn't ban their speech, and they're not saying that the government may have been heavy-handed at times in trying to guide the social media companies. But what they're saying is the plaintiffs in this case didn't sue the social media companies. They only sued the government officials. So basically, you're asking the court to give them redress on the basis of not the injury that was caused to them directly, that is the defendants who caused it, or the people who caused it directly to them were the social media companies. They're asking the court to say that what the social media companies did to them was directly traceable to the government action. And when you line it up, what they say the government did doesn't line up with what they claim the social media companies did to them. So it doesn't line up in time. It doesn't line up by content. My impression coming away from this is that this case is mainly about bad lawyering. Like, they just didn't directly connect up the injuries that they say were caused with the defendants who they say caused them. They just tried to sort of sweepingly say the government did all these bad things, and at some point in time, the social media companies edited some of their posts or suppressed some of their posts, and therefore we should be able to sue these government officials, even if they can't connect the injuries to the government officials they're complaining about. So I think this case is probably not going to be all that important in the end, because they decided it based on standing, which means they didn't rule on any of the merits. They didn't say it was a good thing for the government to do what they did. They basically said the way the case was pleaded by the plaintiffs, they didn't connect up the injuries with the people who they say caused the injuries.
But if there's a pandemic tomorrow or a war, right, and people start on saying that the war is illegitimate and other people say the war is legitimate and they're debating back and forth weapons used about, or they start saying controversial things about what the national policy is, are they going to be potentially banned and shadow banned?
Well, yes, but what the court is saying is if you were asking us to, like, redress the past injuries, then we could do that. But what they're saying is we want you to look into the future and enjoin these government actors from messaging or, you know, from communicating with these social media companies, which is a different thing. In other words, the plaintiffs in this case didn't say these terrible things were done to me, therefore give us damages, give us some financial
money, yeah,
compensation. What they said is, hey, court, look into the future in your crystal ball and predict what these government officials are going to do going forward. And what the court here says is if you're going to ask us to speculate into the future, you have to make a very strong case that the exact government officials that you're complaining about did things in such a predictable fashion that we can predict they're going to do it again in the future. And they said they just didn't make that case.
Yeah. They alleged 67 federal agencies and officials coerced platforms like Facebook and Twitter to censor individual posts primarily related to COVID-19 restrictions imposed by the past two administrations, as well as the 2020 election results. So
yeah,
it looks like
they're not saying that you couldn't bring a future case. I think what they're basically saying is do a better job, you know, connect up the injuries with the people you say caused the injuries.
All right. Let's move on to other legal things, if we can, Andrew. Judge Cannon is skeptical, according to people that read her remarks and her body language yesterday, and the Mar-a-Lago hearing, that evidence from Mar-a-Lago should be thrown out. Trump's lawyers argued in court that the 2022 search warrant and the classified documents investigation was overly broad and violated Trump's rights. They said the FBI agents took medical records, improperly entered the bedroom of Barron and his wife. Cannon indicated that she's the judge. She was underpersuaded by the defense's arguments, saying the main issue at hand was whether the warrant had been particular enough. Other people say they were FBI. The other case was, the other element was, they were saying that some FBI agents said, I'm not for this. I don't think we should be raiding Mar-a-Lago. The FBI's been through enough controversial with Trump's or everybody else, and they did anyway, and they think that should have been a factor in it. So Judge Cannon getting a lot of criticism of late. Where do you think this one's heading?
Well, I think it's amusing, Brian, that everybody says Judge Cannon's in the tank for Trump, right? And now the problem is that she's not giving Trump's motions enough credit and leeway, right? So it changes from day to day what the complaints are about Judge Cannon. From what I can hear in these reports, it seems to me like the motions that Trump's defense is making or are making is they're standard defense motions that get made in every case where there's search warrants. I've never been in a case that where the evidence had search warrants, where there weren't motions to suppress, where the defendants claimed either that information that was in the warrant shouldn't have been in it, or that not enough information that should have been in the warrant was in it. They always claimed that the warrant didn't allow for searching in various places that the agents did. This happens in every single case. And what generally speaking the law is, which is very favorable to the government, is that if the defense wants to raise those things in the trial, they can argue them to the jury, and it goes to the weight of the evidence, and it goes to, you know, you can suggest to the jury that, you know, maybe the evidence that's in the courtroom hasn't been preserved properly. You know, you can make all kinds of arguments, but that's not a basis to keep the evidence out of the trial completely.
So here's what this Andrew Weissman, he was the one who led the investigation, the Mueller investigation, really did all the work. And just a big Trump hater. Listen to what he says about Cannon.
There's no question she is inexperienced, and she does not have the tools to handle a case that's this complicated. That's clear. There's, you know, everyone's seen that. We also do have the fact that the 11th Circuit, a conservative circuit that she is in, reversed her not once but twice. And those were conservative judges who just thought she was absolutely bonkers in terms of her rulings. And, of course, they both times that she was overturned, her rulings were for Trump. They're always siding with Donald Trump, and it's very, very hard at this point to see her as being anything other than partisan.
So we already know, we told you where this was going. So your reaction to his reaction?
Well, I just think it's moronic. You know, we just spent 5 minutes talking about how she's she seems to be very dismissive of Trump's motions to get the searches suppressed. She's ruled against Trump on a number of things with respect to dismissing the indictment and dismissing counts and the like. And with respect to Andrew, you know, again, the biggest case he ever handled in his career, he got reversed unanimously by the Supreme Court. Now, am I going to sit here say this was the Anderson case, the Arthur Anderson case in connection with the Enron stuff?
Okay.
So am I going to sit here and say that because the Supreme Court found that there was nothing to this case that Andrew brought where he destroyed a business, that he's just bonkers and out of control and no one should listen to a word he says? No, I'm not going to say that. But I think he ought to maybe, you know, think about that and cut some slack here. This judge has not been a judge for a long time. That doesn't mean that she's so inexperienced she can't handle this case. She seems to be handling it fine. The Court of Appeals ruled against her on one thing, where she quite, and I was critical of this at the time, she incorrectly gave Trump a special master after the search was done. There was no basis in the law for that, and she was wrong, and the Court of Appeals ruled against her. That, you know, there's not a judge in the United States who's been on the courts for any length of time that hasn't been reversed at some point by an appellate court, but there's no reason to think that she's in over her head. I think if you want to question the competence here, you should question Jack Smith's competence. If he really wanted to get to trial quickly, what he could have done here is indict this case as an obstruction case. Instead, he larded not one but 32 classified information felonies of the same kind that the Biden Justice Department decided not to bring against President Biden. Against Trump, it wasn't enough to bring one. He brings 32, which anybody who actually has experience with classified information cases could have told you there's no way you're going to get this case to trial anytime soon, because classified information cases are very hard to get to trial quickly. There's all kinds of pretrial stuff that pertains to them that doesn't in the ordinary case. So that's the reason they're mired and they can't get to trial. That's not Judge Cannon's fault. That's Smith's fault.
Absolutely. And by the way, just keep in mind, hey, you're going to get on these documents cases. Hey, Joe, the only reason you're not on trial for the documents case is because you're too incompetent and old. That, according to the special prosecutor, your attorney general named. So that's a pretty tough one to overcome.
Yeah, and not only that, Brian, I make the point, I wrote about this at National Review today. You know, Jack Smith is trying to save his appointment in Florida because it's under they've made a very substantial motion that he's not qualified under the Constitution. And what he has said in response is that his appointment is appropriate because he's closely supervised by the attorney general. Now, put aside that the attorney general has maintained for 2 years that he doesn't closely supervise Smith and that he's an independent actor. Garland is the one who is the ultimate decision maker here. He makes the ultimate decisions by all of the special counsels. And he is the one guy who runs the Justice Department. And he is the guy whose ultimate decision making is that Biden gets a complete pass and Trump gets 32 felony counts for the same exact charge.
Yes. If he's supervising, he's supervising, right? That's
well,
it.
Well, I guess it depends on the day.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, we got to take Jack Smith at his word. A quick question. When it comes to immunity, are the Supreme Court really oblivious to the fact that there's a debate tomorrow? Will they wait till Friday or will they try to be a factor and weigh in tomorrow?
I think that they certainly don't want to be a factor. They don't want to be a factor in the debate. And it's funny. I was talking with Pete just before we came on and said we're talking about this very thing. And I said that my wife, who is also a very good lawyer, has also predicted that they're not going to want to get enmeshed in the debate and they'll just put it over till Friday. And I think that's probably right. But, you know, look, the court is the court. They do what they do. If they end up giving us immunity tomorrow, it won't be because they care about the debate. I bet there's such frenetic activity going on at the court right now that they don't even, you know, if they even know there is a debate tomorrow, I'd be surprised.
Really? Okay.
Well, I just think that they're now at the point. I mean, if you've ever been on trial, you get this. But like when you're on trial and it's at the end, you're working like close to 24-hour days. I mean, you're working like 16, 18-hour days to get finished. You just don't have a lot of time for what else is going on in the world.
Understood. But so much you go, hey, by the way, can we wait till Friday? We don't really want to be.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, somebody tell Alito it's Friday and wake Katanji, whatever her name is.
Right.
Yeah, we'll see.
I mean, we got enough going on tomorrow.
Yeah,
right?
Please, hand them a TV guide before they leave today. Andy McCarthy, thanks so much. Always an education.
Thanks,
appreciate it. All right, we come back. I see your calls in Chester. I see you up there, Ron. I see you up there, Robert. Back in a moment with you.
Learning something new every day. On the Brian Kilmeade Show. Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Everybody seems to be saying the same thing. It's inflation. It's pocketbook issues. It's things like that that hit us every day in our everyday lives. And you guys are talking about Ukraine and Gaza and Israel and democracy. I agree with you. Democracy is on the line. It just doesn't seem to connect with the people. I mean, I could go through the stats here of the people he's losing. Mm-hmm. It's a little scary because he's losing the people who are supposed to be the ones in the Democratic camp.
Bill Maher is speaking his mind on Friday's edition of his show, saying that he's losing Hispanics. He's losing a great number of Hispanics. He's going to get the majority of the black vote, but he's lost about 15-20% of the black vote. He's lost young people. Believe it or not, he's gained on seniors. I can't understand that, because seniors must understand that what it looks like to slowly lose your grip. So he understands how it's even close, and that's why he's losing every battleground state. It's alarming to Bill Maher. Robert in New Jersey. Hey, Robert.
Hey, Brian. Excellent show. Thanks, as always. I think if it gets to be a mudslinging contest, no matter what, Trump loses. I think Maher actually was a great segue into this, because if he just stays on the economy, the safety of the people, crime, and, you know, and the border, it's a home run. But I don't know if our ex-president's going to be able to stay away from that mudslinging, which it never helps him, because it just seems never to help him.
Yeah, I mean, killing the mics, cutaways, they're going to 2 minutes, 1 minute, 2 minute, 1 minute. It'll help if he has quicker answers, because he's had a chance to judge not what Biden says he's going to do, but what he did. So he's got a chance. And I talked to his people yesterday. He blew everybody away when they were talking about these issues, along with the one-liners. So we'll see what happens. Chester in New Jersey. Hey, Chester.
Hey, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. Always listen to you and the great one.
Thank you.
I have one opinion and one question. One is, I don't know if it's a good idea to pick a senator or a guy from the House, because we need them where they're at. And second, I never hear anybody mention anything about Morgan Ortegas for, like, a vice president.
Yeah, I don't think that she's politically oriented. She's more State Department, military service, and pundit. But she's, I know Mike Pompeo is a big fan of hers. Everybody here at Fox is. But just not possible. They're looking for a lawmaker. I wouldn't worry about Ohio so much. I think they got a lot of strong candidates in Ohio. But it's important, I know, if J.D. Vance is a pick. And in Florida, DeSantis could name himself. Because keep in mind, he's term limited out.
Hey, it's Clay Travis. Join me for Outkick the Show as we dive deep into a mix of topics. New episodes available Monday to Friday on your favorite podcast platform. And watch directly on outkick.com/watch.
Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.